Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on Gold Radio Cafe. It's Friday, November 16th, 2012, and welcome to the Gold and Silver Financial Review. My name is Bosco Kucharovich, and this program is brought to you by Central Metals. We understand the problem, and we have the answer: gold and silver bullion investments. Our website is centralmetalscorp.com, and our phone number is 519-915-7542. We will be accepting email questions during the program, and you can direct those to mail@centralmetalscorp.com. We've got a lot of things to talk about this week, and as usual, we'll bring in our co-host from Calgary. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Bosco. Lots to chat about and lots of economic and global events going on, aren't there?
Yes, yes, there's always something to talk about. They keep us on our toes, I guess. Always some new buzzwords or new issues coming about, new political decisions. Last week we had the election and so on to talk about. And this week, one of the hottest topics, I guess, is the fiscal cliff. And we have a question from one of our regular listeners, Vinny, asking us to explain the fiscal cliff and the issues surrounding it. And Jeff, did you want to take that for Vinny and explain to him what it all means and how it's going to affect our economy?
Absolutely. Let's wander through a bit of history now, and let's wander through a bit of being responsible governors of the global economy, being the Americans driving the economy. When we get into power and when these guys start to manipulate the economy, they park themselves in a place that says, we will do prudent things, and we will not overspend, and we will do this and that and the other thing. So let's fall back a bit of history into the creation of the Federal Reserve. When Paul Warburg designed the Federal Reserve and the legislation, the Federal Reserve Act, it was designed in the early 1910, and it was passed into law in 1913. Just before it was passed into law, everybody who was a member of the Federal Reserve Bank looked at him and said, Paul, heavens to Betsy, there's so much teeth in here. How is it that we're going to actually be able to manipulate and use our powers to create a banking cartel? And Paul said, shush, boys, everything's good. We'll get it passed into law and we'll change it afterwards. And they sort of looked at him and went, okay. So sure enough, the Federal Reserve Act was passed in with lots of teeth in it. You can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And yet, very shortly thereafter, much of that was repealed to give the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury, effectively, because they work hand in hand, the capacity to print money and do as they please. So now the fiscal cliff, which has created, Bosco, both the TSE and the Dow and the global indices, the marketplaces, have started to fall merely because 1 minute after the U.S. election, there's this looming thing on the horizon called the fiscal cliff. Now, the fiscal cliff, in easy terms, is this. In governing the U.S. economy, the governors got together, the Senate and the House of Representatives got together and said, well, we want to show everybody that we're being prudent, so at this point in time, which is about now, we're going to create a fiscal cliff. So we're going to create automatic tax hikes and automatic spending cuts so that everybody knows that we're being responsible. So next Thursday at 5 o'clock, we will just have to be responsible. So now the markets are going, oh, my goodness. The regulators are going, oh, my goodness. The government is going, oh, my goodness. The big money is going, oh, my goodness. And really, it is just like the debt ceiling that they repeal. Well, the debt ceiling, we can't borrow any more money. Well, boys, you have to. And so they went, okay, well, we will. I think that this fiscal cliff will be dealt with by the government going, well, forget the automatic tax hikes and forget the spending cuts. Now, that's yet to be seen. Don't know whether that will happen, but that's what everybody is fussing about right now, and that's why the markets are acting so fretfully. Now, that being said, stranger things have happened, Bosco, but the fiscal cuts, the automatic tax hikes, and the spending cuts are what is referred to as the fiscal cliff. And we're seeing great tumult on the planet in this, and we're seeing great concern over it in the marketplace. And is it the tempest in a teacup? I don't know. What do you think, Bosco?
Well, I mean, I know that they have the obviously the financial system or the balance sheet of the U.S. government is terrible. They have, as we mentioned off air earlier, they have $16 trillion is the national debt of the United States, and apparently the fiscal cliff as January 2013 come about there, I don't know exactly what date, but they're supposed to cut $1.2 trillion off, you know, the spending, and they're going to raise taxes, I guess, to balance it out, or they're thinking. These are the issues that they're discussing. And, you know, I just don't see no way that they're going to do that. They're going to figure some way around it or to get away from it, and they're just going to either raise the debt ceiling or come up with some kind of other financial measure to print more money or expand their debt. If they do slash the deficit by $1.2 trillion, I mean, they're going to have to get that money from somewhere. They have to cut this or, like, get the money from Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security, but those things can't be touched, especially Social Security in the U.S. It's funded by the payroll tax, and that's not part of the government, I guess, it's not an option for the government to go into that money. They should have thought about this before they started these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. So I think they have no other choice, but they're going to continue to expand the balance sheet and print money, and they're going to probably come up with some new buzzword next year. They're not going to call it quantitative easing or stimulus or whatever, but they'll figure out some new word or whatever to pay for everything. And it's just
the creativity of a government.
The
creativity of a government in crisis lends itself to some pretty bizarre actions. Now let's also, as we are wont to do every now and again, ladies and gentlemen, let's sort of tie in the globe to the U.S. to the Chinese elections, and to what it does, in fact, and how it portends to our position and our embrace of gold. I want to talk to another one of Vinny's references, is Hurricane Sandy. Now, when Hurricane Sandy first arrived, my understanding, Bosco, is it was a hurricane that wasn't an enormous hurricane in terms of the velocity of its winds, but it had girth that was quite profound, and it also hit New York in quite a spectacular fashion. And when they first started to publish the economic impact they had, they started to say $6 or $8 or $9 billion worth of damage. However, really, now the numbers are starting to get changed and augmented, and it's looking in the $50, $40, $60 billion range. And what it's also done, which they don't figure out at the time, or they underestimate so as not to fret everybody out, what they've underestimated is the fact that they thought it was going to be 9, now it's 50, so it's 5 or 6 times as large in terms of how much they're going to have to spend. But what it also does is it takes out of the economy, which because it is the most populated area in the States, is the East Coast, it takes the economy down a tank, because there's a whole bunch of the U.S. economy right there. So the effect that it's going to cost them a bunch of money, that's one thing. But the other effect is that it compromises the economy. It turns unemployment numbers higher. It turns productivity lower. It has sort of a domino effect, which is what Bosco and I've been chatting about for a long time, is the domino effect globally is felt locally, but because everything is so connected now, we see the ripple effect of everything happening. So we see the Portugal and the Spanish unemployment numbers have come out, as well as Italy, and the European Bank is saying, well, we will do what we have. We will financially manipulate to quell the worry to mitigate borrowing costs, which is one of the things that happens that the Americans have done. What they've done is they're buying all these bonds back. The banks are full of cash. They've yet to extend any credit because they can't. Nobody has the credit worthiness in their opinion. So then you get Bernanke in there, Bosco, saying, well, we have to start lending this money out. The more money the banks are actually paying to hold money in accounts. Get a load of that. When you put money in your savings account, you think you should get an interest rate? Well, guess what? That interest rate now for the big banks is zero and negative. The banks are actually paying to hold money. So in the throes of all this, you've got an economy sliding, the manipulators of what they want people to think going, well, no, it's not as bad as it is. And then they are looking at each other going, oh, my goodness gracious, this is horrific. And you've got the banks being told by the regulators, pay attention because we think the economy may be going a little further into the tank. And on Jim Sinclair's website, Bosco, there's the banks are being told to test for higher unemployment figures to make sure that the banks can manage this. They don't care about the little banks because they'll just give the little banks to the big banks once they collapse, which we've seen before. There's some big things, big ripple effects, big issues that we've been talking about for months now. The storm on the horizon has arrived. Now it's just a function of how things fall into place. And in the course of all this, the price of gold and the price of silver, in our opinions, we suspect to rise markedly.
Well, that's the positive spin on it. You know, I get to the point where, you know, we talk about, well, being in the business, you know, talking about all the problems in the U.S. and the global economy and so on, and it seems like, you know, you end up becoming a pessimist. Well, I would like to say I'm a realist, and then you want to put a positive thing on it. I mean, the gold is the place to be. It's outperformed every asset over the past 12 years, and silver as well. You know, the mining companies now are at a low point. You know, it's a good buying opportunity for miners. You know, and other areas of the market and economy are not doing well. And, I mean, jobs are going overseas. And this is one of the things that, you know, I wanted to address regarding Hurricane Sandy as well. Apparently, during the I was watching a video this morning. During the Roosevelt administration, in the 1930s, there was a major hurricane on the East Coast as well. And apparently within Roosevelt took action right away to help the people. He called in the National Guard, he called in the Army, the Navy, the utilities workers, and so on. And apparently they had the economy and that area of the East Coast all back to normal in 1 month's time. Okay. We're at a point with Hurricane Sandy now. It's 2 weeks. About 2 weeks into it, and the situation hasn't changed, and in some cases has even gotten worse. Obama hasn't really done any major decision making to help out the people on the East Coast. You have other charity organizations in other countries. I know even here in Windsor, some of the firefighters or disaster relief workers went out there to see if they could help. I mean, where's the president in these times of needs? He should be, you know, leading the charge to help out those people on the East Coast. I know I got a lot of clients out there, too, and they're telling me it's just terrible. Some of them, I was talking to one client yesterday. He said he didn't have power for 13 days, no electricity, and it's, you know, it's not easy. I know what it's like. I lived in Florida for 3 years, and I lived through hurricanes, and not having not having power or water, I was stuck for 7 days, and it's not pretty, let me tell you. You know, you're in the dark, no electricity, so I couldn't cook anything. I was eating canned food and sardines for about a week, and water, and you know, it's not easy. And those people, to add to the distress, you know, in most cases, their homes are wiped out or demolished, and all their furniture is waterlogged, and it's out on the streets now waiting to get picked up by, you know, the dumpsters and so on. You know, and it's just, you know, the government's not there to help. Same thing that happened during Hurricane Katrina in, when was it, in 2004, 2005, I think. You know, President Bush wasn't out there till like 3 days later to try and help people, or to send what's the aid organization over there? I forget what they call it, but you know, it's just, I don't know. It seems like that the government doesn't really care much. It's, oh, it's up to you. You guys gotta, or let the state handle it. They'll take care of it. So
I think Boston.
I really feel bad for them.
One of the things we did chat about pre-election was how important it would be for Obama to be seen as taking care of the potential hurricane victims. And so
right.
They did. They made a big fuss up front. They created a big PR campaign, and you and I even chatted about it. We
yeah.
think that this saved Obama's election, because people would have gone, well, we're going to vote for the guy because he's going to take care of us. And now that the election has happened, what is happening is people are still out of electricity. They're still having a go. The New Jersey people are having a real go. And so, as you said, in Florida without electricity is a bit of a pickle. And again, it falls back into the place where we've reiterated over and over and over again. It is naive of any of our listeners to think that the government will take care of you. Very important to be self-reliant here. It's very important for you to see things from a macro as well as a micro level. And so consequently, I suspect, Bosco, you now probably do have a day or two or five or a week's worth of water on hand. You probably have a day or two or five or a month's worth of food on hand. When this kind of stuff happens, certainly the coastal areas in the hurricane scenarios, it behooves us to be prepared.
Sure.
Just as it behooves be economically prepared. We see
oh, yeah.
a lot of stuff happening. We're also seeing, Bosco, a whole bunch of unrest in the Gaza Strip and the Israelis. And I mean, we're seeing, again, this bubble to the surface, and everybody preparing us for more strife, more confrontation, more upset. Tis a fractured time, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, you hit the nail on the head. Being prepared is part of it all. You know, you can't count on the government, and a lot of people do that, and you're right. I actually have a high-end water filter that my wife and I, every day we fill up jugs of water, and they're stored in the basement, and this water filter you know, can clean rainwater and I guess water from the river or from the lake, put it through, and then it's drinkable. We're storing water. I have seeds for the garden. I'm trying to learn how to garden and smoke meat and store food and stuff like that. And you just rotate it every once in a while. We eat, you know, some of the food we've stored, and then restock the shelves. So, but the thing that Jeff, what I find is a lot of people, you know, think, oh, you're doing stuff like that, you think that there's Armageddon or anarchy coming. And no, I mean, people used to do that all the time. I remember when I was a kid, my parents had a huge garden, and we used to have a little cellar that they kept pickled vegetables and things in, pickled peppers and so on. It's the old-fashioned way of living. I mean, people used to do that all the time. It's nothing new. You know, to have your own food sources, and it's I think it's a growing trend. I think gardening and greenhouses and that kind of agriculture in the general sense is going to be in demand It just makes sense, but you can't count on, you know, the local. It's not a local store anymore now. It's the local, what do they call it, big box retailer, you know, that they're going to have supplies of food all the time. If something like Hurricane Sandy hits, you know, the trucks aren't going to be delivering food. The shelves in those big stores are going to get dried out. And I remember, I mean, I've never experienced a hurricane before, but when I lived in Florida, you know, all the brokers that I was working with were telling, oh, you got to get water, you got to get a generator, you got to get batteries, the flashlight, the ice, and ice was a big deal. And I was like, what is all this for? You know, I grew up in Canada here. I never experienced that. And I couldn't believe it, Jeff, when I went to in Florida, Publix is a big grocery chain. I went there one day, it was the last day before the hurricane was supposed to hit, and there wasn't one bottle of water on the shelf. The whole aisle where they had water was completely empty. I never seen anything like that in my life. I couldn't believe
right.
it. You know,
well,
so,
and I think if history serves us, Bosco, and your experience as well, I think this isn't so much, this isn't conspiracy so much. It's just self-reliance.
Yeah.
FEMA failed miserably in during Hurricane Katrina, and we were good on the television. When we watched the tsunami roll through Japan, one of the things that happened in Japan, again, was all of the stores were completely empty of food. We have been lulled into, what's the word, Bosco? We've been lulled into this assumption that all of these things will be readily available. We've also been lulled into an assumption via the fiscal policy of the U.S. and certainly of the globe that they are, every year, they're going to take 1 or 2% away of your purchasing power, of your dollar.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the 1910 or 1913, the dollar, you know, $1 buys what $100 buys today. I'll say that again. $1 100 years ago buys what $100 buys today. This is like an invisible tax. And again, we aren't meaning to fret people or to frighten them. We're meaning to, what's the word, Bosco? Wake them up, let's say.
Yeah.
We want you to know that the U.S. isn't necessarily preoccupied with your best interests. There, did you see the numbers on the election, Bosco? They spent $6 billion to get in. Mitt Romney and Obama spent $6 billion on their campaigning. Hello, just to maintain the status quo and to remain themselves stuck. I mean, hello, that's shocking news. Now the other
No, I was just going to make a quick comment. You know what would have been impressive, though, if one of those presidents took that money and said, you know what, I care more for the country. I'm going to send all of my dollars for the campaign to help the victims of Hurricane Sandy. You know, then the entire country would have just loved that guy. You know, whoever it was, whether it would have been Obama or whatever, but you know. To spend just that fact alone, spending $6 billion on your election campaign, and look what's happening to the country, you know, especially with this natural disaster. I mean, I don't know.
Let's posit this question, Bosco. Is it an example of the expenditure of $6 billion on campaigns? Is it demonstrative of parties that merely want to get into power, or parties who genuinely care about the electorate, who genuinely care about the U.S. I think the front is, and I think the facade is, we care about you, we'll take care of you, we think this and that. However, I do think, and I mean this is the skeptic in us perhaps, I do think that all they care about is getting into power so that they can facilitate what they're doing. And then the irony, according to some schools of thought, is that once they get into power, the individuals who run the $1 trillion worth of wealth all over the planet sit them down and say, look, Bubba, we run things. Here's what you're going to do, and here's how you're going to play it. So, it gets to the point where it is all a facade. It's all just this this silly show. Now, one of the things I want to revisit is Vinny's observation or concern that the U.S. reserve currency status may be being compromised by some of China's fiscal endeavors. He pointed out that they may be starting to create financial contracts that are outside of the realm of the U.S. dollar, and how that will impact it. And here again is part of the financial girth or the financial muscle, if you will, designating government actions and government policy and the like, and which also lends itself, as you know, Bosco, that the Chinese just announced who is going to run the country again. we tell you who runs the country as opposed to you telling us, because we rule you as opposed to we work at your bequest. So the Vinny's position, ladies and gentlemen, and the observation is that the Chinese may be doing financial activities that are outside of the realm of the U.S. dollar. That has enormous implications, and it threatens the very status of the U.S. reserve currency, being U.S. because the reserve currency status goes like this. Everybody in the world agrees that when they do international financial transactions of any size, they will do it in U.S. dollars. And that's how the U.S. has become the economic giant that it is. As soon as that starts to teeter, and as soon as we're seeing gold rise as a result of it, or as soon as other economies start to transact outside of that currency, that reserve currency status, then the demand for U.S. dollars falls. Demand falls for U.S. dollars. The value or the price of U.S. dollars in other currency, and certainly in terms of gold, drops, which means the price of gold goes through the roof. So yes, Vinny, U.S. reserve currency status being threatened will drive the price of gold, and we suspect silver, through the roof. And, you know, as Jim Sinclair pointed out, the fact that it could be at $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 in a relatively short period of time, not only is a reasonable assumption, it is a likely assumption. What do you think, Paul?
Definitely. I mean, that's exactly the way it works. And, you know, people have I still tell people, you know, I've been at this for years now, and people were scoffing at me when I said gold was going to go to 800, and then it went through 800. Then I said, okay, it's going to go to 1,000. No way it's going to go that high. And then after 1,000, it's going to go to 1,600 or 1,500 or whatever. You know, no way it can't. There's no way it's going to correct now. And then, you know, now, you know, on Jim Sinclair's website, he's saying 3,500. But what people, I think, it's not that they don't understand. I think people can't grasp the fact that paper money can be created out of thin air, and the U.S. is doing it. Don't quote me on this, but I believe that there's no currency in the world that has any gold or physical commodity backing to any significant degree. I know Switzerland and the euro have a little bit, but most central banks around the world can print their money anytime they feel like it. So the U.S. is printing their money. They have the reserve currency status, okay? And, you know, when you look back at what happened in Weimar Republic in Germany, you know, gold was, and I think we mentioned it on this program before, gold started out at, it was 75 marks per ounce or whatever. Then it went, during the hyperinflation period, it went as high as 23 trillion marks per ounce. So the fact that gold can go to 1,000 or 10,000 or 20,000, it really doesn't matter. It's you're measuring it against a currency that can be inflated to infinity. I mean, they can print as much as they want. This is what people have a hard time of understanding. The price of gold is directly related to the U.S. dollar. Okay, when you're measuring a currency, it depends on what form of measurement. If you want to measure for example, you want to measure a 2x4, you can measure it in feet, you can measure it in centimeters, you can measure it in inches, in yards, or whatever. You're going to get a different number each time. Same thing when you apply gold to the U.S. dollar. You can measure it in U.S. dollar terms, you can measure gold in euro terms, in Chinese yuan or in Japanese yen or whatever. You're going to get a different number each time. So just the fact that the governments can print money at will, the nominal value of gold is really, it doesn't matter. You have, it's how many ounces you have and that you're in possession of. And that leads us to one of the other questions we had. I had a client that was interested in the vault services that we offer, and he was asking to explain the difference between allocated and unallocated. Allocated gold basically means that it's you are the sole owner of the gold, not the institution that is holding it for you in the vault. So an allocated account means that there's a separate account that you are the owner of, and the gold in that account is either the serial number is recorded and it's placed under your name. You are the sole owner of it. An unallocated account means it's a pool of gold. Your money goes into a pool. There's enough gold in that pool to meet the demand in case anybody wants to take delivery. But the fact is that you're not the ultimate owner. The institution that's holding it for you is the legal owner of that gold. So there's a big difference, and the vault services that we provide are allocated and segregated accounts where you can store your gold in the vault. It's a private vault. It's fully insured. Your gold goes into a little container. That container has a serial number on it. Everything you put in the container, it's exactly the same thing that you're going to get when you want to take delivery or you sell it. So this was a question from Bill in Toronto, and we just wanted to let Bill know that if you want more information, just send us an email and we can address that for you. But, there's, you know, the price of gold, like we said, gold is more of an insurance. And one of the products that we have that, is new on our product shelf is the Mayan gold coin. I know we introduced this a few weeks ago. This is a coin that that Jeff had made, and it's a beautiful coin. It's 4/9 fine. It's about 23 grams. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, in that neighborhood, yes.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful coin. It is available now. Anyone interested, I think, pick one up for yourself. It would be a great heirloom piece, something great to hold, you know, as a souvenir. We have the Mayan calendar end of cycle. Is that right? Coming December 21st of this year. So, you know, it's a special edition coin. It's something that has collector value. So, you know, if you want information or would you like to pick one up, just give us a call. And we could have that sent out to you. They are available now, so anybody that's interested, just give us a call, or you could email Jeff. Jeff, did you want to give out your email for that?
Yeah, our email address is viatao@gmail.com.
Okay. And also our number here is 519-915-7542. Our website is centralmetalscorp.com. And, just wanted to let people know about that. We have now gold is, I'll just give people a quick quote here. And then we got about 10 more minutes left in the program. Gold right now is at $17.14. It's up $1.20. Silver is $32.38. It's down about 7 cents. So I think we're gonna stay around that range for a little while now, but I'm thinking that by the end of the year we should be quite a bit higher on both gold and silver. We got the holiday season coming up. You know, maybe there might not be much volatility and people are gonna be more focused on shopping and and being with family and that kind of stuff. So, I think next year with this fiscal cliff and all the issues that are facing the U.S., I see no reason why gold shouldn't be going much higher. Jeff, is there anything else that you wanted to discuss in closing out here?
Absolutely. I want to chat a little about trading and a little about Jim Sinclair's expose on trading that some weeks ago that you and I had a chance to sort of elucidate and explain to people. But I want to revisit it, if I might, and point out that the trading in the stock market, and chat a little about the ideal versus what actually is transpiring in the market. So the ideal, Bosco, is that you and I and 100 or 1,000 or even 100,000 or even 100 million people get together and we have various businesses that we trade. So that will be the stock markets, ladies and gentlemen, and we all get together and, Bosco, let's go see if we can buy ABC Co. Well, is it sound? Does it have good management? Is its balance sheet sound? Does it produce something that is useful? So all of those things come under just the fundamental evaluation of any company anywhere in the world. And as things grow, that company becomes sought after and its shares become sought after because it's sound and it's viable and all sorts of things happen. Now, as the marketplaces grow, and we now have an incredibly extensive stock market, an incredibly extensive commodity market, we have an incredibly extensive gold and silver trading market, part of the commodity market. So now what transpires is people enter into what I make reference to as sub-optimization, which means, as Bosco knows, it means getting really, really, really good at doing something that's completely unnecessary or completely unfocused on the bigger picture. So then we get into these brilliant financial architects that look upon the trading in and of itself as a means to an end, as opposed to the fundamental backstop of why stock markets were put together in the first place. So then you get these wizards in here that develop algorithmic patterns on how to trade, and now what they do is they merely trade to trade. I see a little trend, it's going down, so we're going to short things, we're going to sell. I see a trend that's going to go up, so we're going to buy things, and we're going to buy. And so they start to make money on the margins. And then what tends to happen is these individuals who manage hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars, get really, really good at merely trading. They don't even care about the fundamentals. And then the really big money figures out how to manipulate them into facilitating how they play the market. So this is how these geniuses, these brilliant financial architects and financial engineers become involved and the lower end of the totem pole become used in manipulating the market to where they want it to go. And consequently, we have traders trading for trading's sake and the big money using the way that the traders work in order to manipulate the market. And this is what we came out with a few weeks ago now, Bosco, and how we showed them how the gold market is manipulated. But I dare say these brilliant people who have trillions of dollars at their capacity have market programs designed in such a fashion that when they want the market to go down and when they want the market to go up, they can do it by manipulating the traders, the lower guys on the trading pool, on the totem pool. This lends itself to the big money decides how and where and when these markets decide. And when they decide that the market is going to crash, which is, it's starting to slide now, right? Bosco, we've seen the markets all come off in the last little bit, and they're saying it's the fiscal cliff, but they will tell the governors, never mind, make it go away. And the government and the people who govern the financial world, they'll just say, okay, well, we're going to push the fiscal cliff back. This is the kicking the can down the road.
Right.
Be forewarned, ladies. There may be a point in time where traders who are not aligned with governments money may be able to trade and game the system in such a fashion that might bring it down. Don't know, possibility. So all of a sudden, these will be rogue traders that are not aligned with the government's policy, and perhaps one of the big banks gets blown up. Some food for thought, Bosco. Some food for thought.
Yeah, no, and this is the, I think, one of the best books that are out there to wake people up to this fact is the Black Swan book by, I forget,
yep.
Nassim Taleb, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, but, you know, these algorithms and technical trading thing, they can't forecast a Black Swan event, which is what happened in 2008. And, you know, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine, because I've been in the industry and I've seen what these, you know, brokers and people do. And you know, a lot of these guys is just, you know, commission based, and they're just trading for trading. But where is all the ingenuity, and where, you know, real business? Where are the people that are going to start real businesses and create jobs? And trading isn't for everybody. And yes, if you're in the business world, in the banking business, and, you know, you want to be in the financial markets, and you have to understand how the system works. Okay, you have to understand some fundamental facts about trading and understanding the economy and so on. And that's fine. We need traders out there and speculators to balance the market. For every buyer, there's a seller. And this is what the whole market is designed for. But when you start introducing, like you said, algorithmic trading, that they're trading just for trading, and there's no, you know, you're trading a stock. Well, did you go and meet the managers of this company? Did you go to the factory to see how they're building their product or whatever? None of this happens anymore. People are just getting on the internet. They're looking at a company, looking at the chart. Oh, this sounds like a good buy. Let's buy this company or short this company. I mean, that's not investing. You that's not the whole point of the stock market. Like you said, you know, the stock market is there to provide an instrument to raise capital for legitimate businesses. And this is where what's happening in the economy, these legitimate businesses and job opportunities, job creators are gone. They're going away. They're going to China, going to India, to Mexico or whatever. But, I mean, it's obvious that in Canada and the United States, we're losing a lot of the middle-class jobs, and this is where the fundamental of the economy is based. You can't base an economy on trading, because what are you producing then? It becomes just a gambling casino. So,
well, so you've made brilliant points, and I want to further that just before we sign off. Here's an interesting optic. In the 70s. The financial services businesses contributed less than 10% to the earnings of the economy, and they're now in the 30s and 40s%. And what Bosco was just making reference to is they don't contribute anything. They are, in fact, facilitators. They're intermediaries.
Yeah.
And what is also happening is, with their brilliance, with their ingenuity, driven by greed, not necessarily driven by the altruistic motivations, but with their ingenuity, they've created a system that they can game in order to benefit themselves and detract from the productivity, from the jobs, as everything as Bosco is making reference to. So it's the old adage, Bosco, if you can manage to, I mean, and now what happens is the big banks, because of the economy sliding down, they aren't lending money. Because of the lack of jobs and unemployment, they're starting to see their loans, the old-fashioned lending money for money. So the only way they can now earn money, one of the only ways, is through trading and through the selling of derivatives. And so with that, let us pay clear attention to the fact that we, as we say over and over again, be mindful of their agenda, because it would be naive to think that their agenda is in your best interests.
Very well, Jeff. We'll leave it at that, folks. Jeff, thank you for joining us today, and listeners, we hope to hear again from you next week. So send us your emails, and have a good weekend, Jeff.
Thanks for allowing us to be of service, ladies and gentlemen. We shall chat with you next week.
Goodbye.